It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
Now, from the most powerful city in the world, a new generation of conservative talk. Fair, fresh, fun. It's the Guy Benson Show with Guy Benson.
It is Monday, March 27th, 2023. I'm Guy Benson. Welcome to a new broadcast week here on the Guy Benson Show. Our website is GuyBensonShow.com. Our podcast is free on demand every day. GuyBensonShow.com, FoxNewsPodcast.com, wherever you get your podcasts. Of course, we recommend listening live as we air. Big lineup today, starting with Gordon Chang later this hour, talking about China, a few developments that you definitely want to hear about. Josh Krasauer in our next hour, talking politics of the day. We also welcome back to the show Congresswoman Kat Kamak of Florida. She was one of the central figures in the TikTok hearing last week. Also a big vote in the House of Representatives on parental rights in education matters. We'll get to all of that with Congresswoman Kamak. And then General Jack Keane also joining us toward the end of the show today as we are very busy coming on the air. And we begin with a Fox News alert. And unfortunately, it's a very sad story developing in Tennessee. In Nashville, there's been a school shooting at a private Christian school. Happened earlier today. And what we know so far is that 3 children and 3 adults have been killed. So 6 victims who have been fatally shot. The shooter was shot and killed by responding police officers who arrived on the scene very quickly. And we are just now learning more and more about the identity of the shooter. We don't really know much about potential motive. One thing that is, I will say, unusual about the shooter's identity is that this was a woman. And disgustingly, appallingly, those of us in the news business, we have had far too many occasions to report on stories like this through the years. And when there's a school shooting, much of the time, the expectation is it was some sort of demented, deeply alienated young man who somehow or another got his hands on guns, often known to authorities, red flags all over the place. And there's just a certain profile when it comes to mass shootings, especially at schools. And you almost never assume that it would be a female suspect. But according to authorities, the individual who has murdered 6 people at this school in Nashville is a 28-year-old white woman who we just heard the police chief, John Drake, in Nashville say there's a belief that this woman may at some point have attended this school. Now, the school is a pre-K through 6 place, and it's attached to a Presbyterian church campus, is my understanding. If it is in fact borne out to be true that this shooter attended the school at some point, that would suggest that point would have been a long time ago. If she was 28 years old today, she's now dead. The time period during which she might have attended this school would have been years ago. So what, 6th graders are 10 or 11? So it's unclear still exactly what the connection is, what the motive is. I don't want to speculate. I don't think conjecture is helpful. Sometimes word of mouth starts getting repeated in the very early minutes and hours of an unfolding event or atrocity like this, and certain things turn out not to be true. So I am just relaying to you what we are learning from authorities and from official sources so far, with the understanding that more information will come in the coming hours and certainly days. And at least some of the things that are initially reported may turn out to be incomplete or inaccurate. Let me just read to you from the breaking news account from the Wall Street Journal. I've added a few other pieces of information and color that we've gotten from authorities just in the last few minutes. They just wrapped up a press briefing moments before we came on the air. President Biden has already spoken about this. We have some of that sound that we'll get to in just a moment. But reading here from the Journal, six people died in a shooting at a private school in Nashville that was carried out by a heavily armed 28-year-old female suspect, according to police. And again, since this was published, I would add, they have further identified her as white and have said that she is believed to have possibly attended the school at some point. Three children and three adults were fatally wounded Monday morning by the suspect, who opened fire at Covenant School in the Green Hills neighborhood, according to the Metropolitan Nashville Police Department. The other reporting that we've seen is that she didn't make it far into the school. There were not classroom shootings. This shooting happened in sort of like a lobby type area at the school. So I don't know, like a front vestibule or hallway type setting. Police shot and killed the suspect within minutes of arriving at the scene. The suspect, who has not been identified, was armed with at least two assault type rifles and a handgun, according to police. So that would be an extremely heavily armed assailant here. We don't yet know which of those apparently three guns in her possession she used in carrying out the murders that she was able to commit before being taken out. But at least the initial belief is that she had three firearms on her person, two rifles and a handgun. The victims have not yet been identified. So you just can only imagine that there are some loved ones who are currently living through an absolute nightmare, or are about to, if they haven't been informed yet. The Covenant School was founded in 2001. It's a private Christian school that enrolls only about 200 students from pre-kindergarten to sixth grade. That's according to the school's website. At the White House earlier, President Biden, this was minutes ago, came out, offered his condolences. He applauded local authorities for responding as quickly as they did. Here's Cut 29.
It's just, it's sick. You know, we're still gathering the facts of what happened and why. And we do know that as of now, there are a number of people who are not going to, did not make it, including children. It's heartbreaking, a family's worst nightmare. And I want to commend the police who responded incredibly swiftly, within minutes, and the danger.
I mean, he used the word sick. I don't know who could disagree. Heartbreaking. Agree again. Commending the responding officers. Three for three. Now, he went on to get a bit into the guns debate as well, reiterating his call for a so-called assault weapons ban. Cut 30.
We're monitoring the situation really closely, Ben, as you know, and we have to do more to stop gun violence. It's ripping our communities apart, ripping the soul of this nation, ripping at the very soul of the nation. And we have to do more to protect our schools so they aren't turned into prisons. You know, the shooter in this situation reportedly had two assault weapons and a pistol, two AK-47. So I call on Congress again to pass my assault weapons ban. It's about time that we began to make some more progress, but there's more to learn. But I just wanted to send my concern and hearts out to so many parents out there.
It sounded like he said that these were AK-47s. I don't think that has been confirmed anywhere. That might have just been a type of gun that went into his head when describing the types of rifles that were allegedly on the person of this shooter. He said we have to be able to protect our schools without turning them into prisons. I mean, you just know that this conversation is coming again. What do you do? but what can actually be done? Disarming law-abiding citizens and reducing their Second Amendment rights is something that will be fought tooth and nail, understandably, by a lot of people. You can't put an armed guard at every door of every school. It's completely impractical. I think throwing police or armed guards out of schools as some sort of performative thing is a very stupid idea. As we've seen a number of places, I don't know what the policies were at this Covenant school. It seems like police were able to get there pretty quickly and neutralize the situation, but not before a lot of blood was shed. I think the one thing that you can just agree on is that this is sick. It is tearing apart communities. I know that a lot of people instantly want to go to their politics on this, right? You look at something that theoretically is unfathomable and yet is extremely fathomable because it happens way too often, school shooting like this, although, again, the profile here of the alleged shooter is very unusual in this case. A female in her late 20s who might have been a former student. But I guess in moments of grappling with uncertainty and anger and grief, and no one looks at this and says, this is fine, this is acceptable, people want to make sense of it. They want to sort of sort their thoughts in a way that feels familiar or makes some degree of sense in a senseless situation. And so we get to our politics, our usual politics. And we're seeing some of that already. We're trying to avoid that here. I've brought you all the available facts that I'm aware of up to this point, so I'm going to take a break. When we come back, I do want to briefly touch on something that perhaps we'll get a little bit more to later on, which is a brand new poll from the Wall Street Journal about American values and the pretty dramatic deterioration of some of those values among Americans broadly, especially among young people. We will dip into that when we return. It's the Guy Benson Show. Stay tuned.
The Guy Benson Show. More next.
We're back. It's the Guy Benson Show. I plan to open today, before we have this breaking news out of Nashville, with a really interesting and in some ways disturbing and disheartening poll from the Wall Street Journal, a cultural poll, taking the pulse of the country, not about Joe Biden and job approval ratings and 2024 election, just how we're feeling about ourselves as a country, what we value in this country. There are a number of findings in the survey that are actually encouraging. I don't want to just sit here and tell you it's all a bunch of doom and gloom. But some of the trends, well, they sort of speak for themselves. With the caveat, as John McCormick at Nash Review has pointed out, that the Wall Street Journal poll has changed its methodology. So there's a trajectory from 1998 to 2019 asking these same questions, and now 2023. There's a new way that they're contacting respondents. It's not a traditional complete telephone poll like it used to be. So that might have something to do with the change. It's not completely apples to apples. That being said, regardless of their methodology, they asked about American values and what things Americans hold dear. And the percentage of Americans who say that the following values are, quote, very important to them, have just dropped precipitously, with one exception. So patriotism, is patriotism very important as a value to you? In 1998, 70% of Americans said it's very important. In 2019, 61% of Americans said it's very important. This year, 38% say it's very important. A huge drop. I mean, cut almost in half since 1998. What about religion? Religion as a value. And I understand that these things are open for interpretation and you might parse it out. I'm just describing what the poll says. Is religion very important to you? In 1998, 62% said yes, very important. 2019, about half, 48% said yes, very important. Big drop. This year, 39%, an even bigger drop. A shrinking minority say that religion is very important to them as a value. What about having children? You know, growing a family. 59% in 1998 said, yes, it's very important. 43% in 2019. Now it's 30%, less than one third. Community involvement. This is a weird one because in 98, it was 47% said being involved in your community is a very important value. That number spiked to 62% just a few years ago and has now crashed to 27%. People just aren't engaging with each other as much anymore or valuing or prioritizing that. The only value that has increased over time as very important is money. In 1998, 31% of Americans said money was very important to their values. 41% by 2019 and now 43%. So money on the rise, everything else falling. I mean, just as a group, Americans are less excited about America, less concerned with God, less interested in having children or families, less engaged in their communities, but more interested in making money. That's where we are right now. There is a big generational gap on this. The Wall Street Journal looked at the youngest Americans, 18 to 29-year-old, versus senior citizens, 65-plus. On patriotism, there is a 36% gap. 6 in 10 older Americans say that patriotism is very important to them. Just over 20% of young people say the same. Having children, just over 20% of young Americans say that is very important to them. Religion, just over 30% for young Americans, a 24-point gap with senior citizens. Hard work still has very high overall numbers, which is good, but there's a 14-point gap with young people putting double digits, less value on hard work. There's a partisan split on a lot of this stuff. Republicans being much more openly patriotic and religious. Now, I will say, before people start really wringing their hands, and I went on a Twitter thread about this, when you add very and somewhat important together, as opposed to not that important or not important at all, a lot of these traditional American values still have very high responses. 94% saying hard work is important. 90% saying tolerance of others is important, although the very important number has crashed from 80% down to just 58%. We are less tolerant of each other. Getting married, 70% say it's important. Self-fulfillment, 91% say that's important, but how's that going for us? And among young people, the numbers are strikingly worse. And separately, we know that young people are dealing with just a huge barrage of anxiety and depression these days. And you have to wonder, are these things potentially connected? I think so. We're back. It's the Guy Benson Show in D.C. on this Monday. Thank you for tuning in. GuyBensonShow.com, our online home. Podcast is on demand, no charge, every day when the show is over. We are joined now by Gordon Chang, author of The Coming Collapse of China, his Twitter feed at Gordon G. Chang. Gordon, welcome back.
Thank you so much, Guy.
I want to start with this clip. It's from an interview that John Kerry gave to Yahoo News, and he, of course, is the climate czar for the Biden administration. And it pertains, of course, to China. Here's what he said. He was talking about the CCP through a climate lens, but he said a few things that raised some eyebrows in the process of answering this question. Cut 19.
Now, China is the largest deployer of solar panels. In China, they have deployed far more renewable energy than we have or than Europe has. So, yes, they're behind and it's a problem. Coal is a problem. But that's why it's important. We work with China. We reach out to China. And that's what we're trying to do. And the president has tried very hard. Our president has tried hard to separate climate from the other issues that are real that we obviously have with China. But we can't get bogged down by that because this is a universally felt existential challenge to the planet. And it's important that the two largest economies in the world work to try to resolve it.
So first of all, Gordon, this is sort of an echo of what we heard from the energy secretary the other day, Jennifer Granholm, talking about how much we can learn from China when it comes to carbon emissions, even though they dwarf our emissions. It's not even close. But he said, look, there's two tracks here. There's the climate track, which is existential and crucial. And then there's all that other stuff. And we just can't get bogged down by the other stuff. Would you just care, Gordon, to remind us what those other issues are that Kerry's saying we ought not get bogged down with?
Well, last year, when we have the numbers, Guy, it will appear that there were more than 80,000 Americans who were killed by doses of illegal Chinese fentanyl, which the Communist Party supported the fentanyl gangs because in a near total surveillance state, these gangs could not operate without the blessing and approval of the Communist Party, which, by the way, makes its state banks available for laundering of the proceeds of these fentanyl gangs. So that's one thing. But second of all, of course, China deliberately spread COVID-19 beyond its borders to level the playing field. That's more than 1.1 million Americans who have been killed by this disease. China steals somewhere in the neighborhood of half a trillion with a T, dollars of U.S. intellectual property each year. The list goes on and on. But you cannot have a cooperation with a regime, which, by the way, believes that for it to survive, it must destroy the United States. So John Kerry, I think, is completely misguided when he says, oh, well, we can work with China, even though it's killing Americans.
Well, and I mean, just crushing dissent and democracy in Hong Kong, the genocide against the Uyghurs and other forms of prosecution and deeply Orwellian surveillance state abuses. I mean, the human rights abuses, we didn't even touch on half of them, it feels like, and we could just keep going. And I understand, you know, Kerry went out of his way to say, look, we obviously have these other issues and they're real, but we can't get bogged down by that because ultimately the climate is number one. And I don't know. I feel like a lot of Americans, we were just talking about American values in the last segment. I'm not sure you can balance those values, even if you agree with Kerry on the urgency of the climate issue, and a lot of Americans don't. But even if you buy that, how you describe these other things as sort of secondary or tertiary and things that we ought not worry too much about or get bogged down or, you know, waylaid by? That to me is probably music to the CCP's ears, but that's about it.
Yes. And to put a point on something you mentioned, China, through various forms of genocide, and it's not just the Uyghurs, but China's been committing other genocidal acts, has actually killed more people than the Third Reich did with its genocidal policies. So this is immoral for Kerry to say that.
Yeah, I mean, there's also these, you know, internment re-education camps against ethnic and religious minorities. I mean, it's sort of amazing, even by kind of the progressive, if you want to call them woke, standards, social justice that they talk about, you've got a regime that is running concentration camps for Muslims. And you've got a high-ranking Biden administration official saying, well, let's not get bogged down with that because we really have to focus on the climate. And by the way, the Chinese are the worst polluters in the world by far, but you wouldn't really know that from that answer either. Just on the terms that he's trying to focus on, he was soft-pedaling China's culpability.
Yes. And it is despicable. The Republic is not safe when John Kerry has a diplomatic passport. We're at risk.
We have the vice president heading over to Africa. She's there now. And setting aside her effectiveness as a leader, and Lord knows we have all sorts of things that we say about that and that question here on this show, but I know the First Lady was just in Africa. Now the Vice President is there. I believe the President is also scheduled to go. There's a concerted effort to engage on that continent. And some of that, in my mind, has to at least be arising from this concern that China is just throwing its influence and money around like crazy, not just in Africa, all over the world, but they've made a point of emphasis in Africa as well. There's a lot of key strategic minerals and resources in Africa that America needs to be worried about. Do you see this push by the administration as something of a response to China? Whether you think it's going to be sufficient, whether you think that, you know, they're going to be effective, do you think they're at least making an attempt here?
Oh, they certainly are, and I applaud them for that. I would actually prefer, though, that the First Lady, the Vice President, and the President go to Latin America and the Caribbean, because the issues with regard to our hemisphere are the same as with Africa, except, of course, this affects American security in a much more tangible way. Now, by the middle of this century, Africa will be considered the same way that we consider East Asia now, the world's powerhouse. But that's a little bit down the road, Guy. And right now, we've got some critical problems in Latin America and the Caribbean. So if it's a quibble, I would prefer to see the administration devote its resources to this hemisphere. But I think it's a great thing that they're in Africa.
Since you brought up Latin America, I saw the headline just a few days ago that Honduras, right here in our backyard and in our Western Hemisphere, has established diplomatic ties with Beijing and has cut diplomatic ties with Taiwan, which, of course, Beijing doesn't recognize as a country. The American position on that is actually somewhat ambiguous for a reason. My position is not ambiguous. Taiwan is a country and it's a democracy and it's an ally of ours. But here is in North America, right? It's a Central American country, but technically a North American, Latin American country, making a concrete, proactive decision to get much closer to the Chinese and take the step of severing diplomatic ties with Taiwan. What are the implications there?
The implications there are Taiwan now has only 13 countries that diplomatically recognize it. I think Taiwan did the right thing in not putting up with blackmail from Honduras. But I also think, Guy, that if we were to focus our efforts on Central America, and we have a lot of reasons to do that, this breaking of ties with Taiwan would not have occurred. So, for instance, we Americans have a big interest in making sure that manufacturing goes to Central America. That would stabilize those societies. It means people would not be pressuring our southern border. It means our factories wouldn't be feeding the Chinese beast. And for those climate fans, it would put a lot of less carbon in the air to get our products from the Northern Triangle, Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador, rather than from across the ocean, because those big container ships pour a lot of carbon into the air. So John Kerry, you should be talking about getting our manufacturing into this side of the Pacific.
Gordon Chang, what is your assessment thus far of the House Select Committee on China? From what I've seen, there's been some pretty serious bipartisanship and some seriousness of purpose on that front. Obviously, they've just gotten going. It just got stood up a matter of weeks ago. Early days, initial assessment, what do you say?
Great start, because Chairman Gallagher is trying to build that bipartisan consensus. And we've got a lot of issues with China, and a lot of those issues are urgent. I'm sure this committee will not be able to act fast enough, but Mike Gallagher is doing the best that he can under some very difficult circumstances.
We have later in the program Congresswoman Kat Kamak, who will be here from Florida. She featured prominently last week in the TikTok hearings on Capitol Hill with their CEO. A lot of pointed questions put to him by members of both parties during that hearing. Obviously, a lot of people, at least looking at this from a policy national security perspective, are not thinking about TikTok through the prism of silly dances and funny clips and that kind of thing, which I understand the appeal. A lot of people love it. But there's a dark, insidious side to this and the connection to the Chinese Communist Party. And it seemed, at least for much of that hearing, minds were focused on what actually mattered, Republicans and Democrats for the most part alike. We'll ask Congresswoman Kamak about her impression coming up in the next hour, since she was asking some of those questions that got a lot of publicity. As you watched it and you watched the CEO try to respond, occasionally squirm a little bit, downplay the CCP connection, What were some of your takeaways?
I think that the CEO of TikTok, Xu Chu, actually confirmed everybody's worst fears about the app with the way he answered and didn't answer questions. You know, it's clear TikTok does two things. First of all, it steals data. It surreptitiously takes that data and illegally sends it to China. And TikTok app is used to amplify Chinese and Russian propaganda. The Russian propaganda is there because China has actually tried to make sure that Russia's message got out to the world. So they have made their propaganda platforms available to Moscow. These are critical national security threats, Guy, and this is a do-or-die moment, because if for one reason or another we can't ban TikTok or force its sale to a U.S. company, then it's very clear that we cannot deal with obvious threats, which means we could lose our country.
Yeah, I mean, it just seems like enough of a problem. Look, they've banned it on government phones, right? And this was one of the questions that John Kirby was getting over the weekend on the Sunday shows. You guys are banning it on government phones, that seem to be getting tougher on TikTok, and yet President Biden appeared in a TikTok video because that is politically beneficial. There have been some criticism of the Democrats trying to have it both ways on TikTok. Some of them are coming out, you know, swinging hard in favor of TikTok, perhaps for political reasons. For the most part, as I said, I've been pleased to see the cooperation and the agreement on this issue. But based on that, if we can't take meaningful action in light of that agreement and in light of what's obviously a national security concern, then what can we do if push comes to shove? That's the worry that I think you're referencing here.
Absolutely. You know, we as a nation did not pay attention to Islamic terrorists, even though in 1993 they killed six Americans by detonating a bomb under the North Tower of the World Trade Center. And we just ignored it until, of course, 9/11, when 2,977 Americans lost their life on a single day. And I just hope that this is not the same story with regard to China. That with regard to China, that we unite only after Americans are killed. But that's the way this is going. And I know that TikTok's lobbyists are saying to Democratic Party legislators, look, a ban on TikTok would disproportionately affect the Democratic Party's political position. But if Democratic Party operatives and legislators succumb to that argument, what they're doing is they are basically supporting the Communist Party against the United States.
Well, it's like we hear so often this lecturing about the need to put our country over any political party, party over country. That's the refrain. That would be a black and white example of it here. Even if the Democrats feel like their connection to young people is crucial and TikTok is an important tool for them to pursue that political goal, a country over party move here would be not putting the political considerations above the national security ones. I mean, it seems pretty clear cut.
Yeah, this is a test for the Democratic Party. Now, there are tests for the Republican Party. And I have to say the Republican Party sometimes fails these country over party tests. But this is a critical test for the Democratic Party, and we'll be watching. I'm a political independent, not a member of either party, and I'm watching.
Gordon Chang, last question very briefly. Chairman Xi meeting at the Kremlin last week for multiple days with Vladimir Putin. They're getting awfully chummy. We'll talk to General Keane about that later on. Just some of your analysis based on what you saw.
When Xi Jinping left on Wednesday, he said to Vladimir Putin, change is coming that has not occurred over the past 100 years. And then he said to Putin, you and I together will be driving that change. Basically, what Xi Jinping is saying is that the United States is no longer a factor because we're not driving change. They've made it very clear how they feel. We need to respond.
Gordon Chang wrote the book, The Coming Collapse of China. On Twitter, he is at Gordon G. Chang. Gordon, thank you.
Thank you so much, Guy.
We will step aside and come right back. It's The Guy Benson Show.
Fresh conservative talk. Guy Benson Show.
Welcome back to The Guy Benson Show. Well, last week was kind of anticlimactic when it came to the Trump grand jury in New York. We talked a lot about what might happen Nothing ended up happening, at least last week. Donald Trump had predicted he would be arrested last Tuesday. Obviously, that didn't happen. He just told NBC News earlier that he now believes that Alvin Bragg's office has already privately dropped the case against him because it's such a weak case. Now, I have no idea where he's getting that. That could just be another thing that he's throwing out into the universe. I think Bragg's office would be wise to drop it for all the reasons that we've talked about. Whether they're actually going to do that or have done that, I mean, we have no indication thus far. What we do know is that the grand jury is back in action. After a couple delays toward the latter part of last week, they have reconvened today. And the New York Times has reported that there is a new witness that is being questioned in that probe before this grand jury. And that witness is David Pecker, who is the official, the gentleman from the National Enquirer, who had all sorts of connections to Trump. And I believe there were allegations of catch-and-kill type stories involving, if I'm not mistaken, Stormy Daniels, which, of course, that whole episode, the hush money, is at the center of this particular criminal probe. So this is a high-ranking official at the National Enquirer whose exact title escapes me at this moment. But I remember he had come up in previous iterations of this story because this story has been out there for years. So there's a possibility that the grand jury could hand down an indictment even today of the former president, or not at all, based on rumors that the grand jurors are skeptical, or maybe this witness today from the Enquirer will make a difference. Who knows? It's all behind closed doors. We're following it as best we can on The Guy Benson Show. Another hour coming up. Stay tuned.
From the most powerful city in the world. Unconventional talk from a fresh, unconventional conservative. Guy Benson Show.
Our second hour is here on The Guy Benson Show, Monday edition. Thanks for tuning in. GuyBensonShow.com, our website. Our podcast is always free of charge. Guy Benson Show on Twitter and Instagram. That's the handle. You can follow me on those platforms as well. Personally, Guy P. Benson. A lot to get to here on the program. First, though, a Fox News alert. The Dow closing up 195 points today in the green at 32,432. Back with us now is Josh Krasauer, editor-in-chief at Jewish Insider and senior politics reporter at Axios. Josh, welcome back.
Hey, Guy. Great to be back on the show.
Just very quickly, I wanted to get your reaction to some overseas news. There have been weeks of huge protests in Israel over a proposed judicial overhaul by Prime Minister Netanyahu and his government. And there have been a lot of dissenting voices coming out right, left, and center about it, and these big protests in the streets. And it seems like finally it came to a head. Prime Minister Netanyahu announcing today that they're going to just punt the issue into the next session of parliament. So not a complete retreat from some of these reforms that he says are necessary. And I've seen some arguments in favor of them, but also an acknowledgement that it is so divisive and unpopular right now that it seems like you could describe this as something of a climb down. What do you make of this?
Yeah, I mean, it's a face-saving measure from Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu, who, with a very right-wing coalition, was trying to push for a very ambitious judicial overhaul that the candidate himself didn't really campaign for, but ended up becoming there's a real divide in Israel, but similar to what we see in the United States between sort of the populists who feel like they've been left out of society, feel that they're underrepresented on the Israeli court and the elites. And you see this divide, Guy. Actually, it's not just Israel. It's in almost every Western democracy in recent years, a polarization between the elites versus the average Joes. And that's essentially what this fight is about, even though, you know, it's really about the role of the courts and how much power they have. But there's a real discontent among religious Israelis and you know, Israelis that haven't been represented in society, that they feel like they're being looked down upon. And that's what this is ultimately about. It's a cultural battle. It's something of a civil war that's taken place, and it's filled into the streets of Tel Aviv and Jerusalem and throughout the state of Israel. And look, I think it was not smart politics for Netanyahu to continue pushing this through when it was clear that it wasn't just liberal parties or left-wing parties that were opposed to it. But, you know, there was a lot of opposition from the center and even some conservatives, center-right folks, in both Israel and even the American Jewish community in the United States. So, I mean, he backed down for now. I heard the speech. It doesn't sound like this is necessarily a permanent surrender and withdrawal of this controversial legislation. But look, it's a lot of people in Israel I've talked to in the last 24 hours are comparing this to sort of like January 6th, that it's just a war between two different factions in the country that has poured into the streets and has shut down essentially the entire country for the last 24 hours.
Speaking of January 6th, much closer to home, President Trump had a big rally in Waco, Texas over the weekend. Thousands of people attended. The president played this January 6th choir song that I guess includes inmates who called up and lent their voices to this song. His voice is on the track. It's been sort of topping the charts. A lot of Trump supporters have been out there buying it and downloading it. It was played at the rally. Trump stood there very solemnly with his hand on his heart. Just an interesting choice there, as you know, he's clearly kind of not campaigning on January 6th, but leaning into some of the politics around it. What did you think of the rally in Waco? I know some people were commenting about the selection of the location. We know Waco, Texas, some of the history there. The speech that Trump gave, some of it was very typical, like playing the hits, the stuff that we expect from him. He of course, went after Ron DeSantis quite a lot to pretty muted response from the crowd, it seemed to me. So a lot of potential observations coming out of that Waco experience, Josh. Were there any big ones for you?
Yeah, look, I mean, it goes back to what we've seen in American politics for the last, you know, 7 years, and that the Trump coalition, the MAGA, the biggest hardcore supporters of the former president, they're not really united by policy, but really by a shared grievance against the elites, against the White House and Biden and the Democrats, and also the Republicans that are, you know, the more establishment and traditional Republicans. I mean, we heard that at CPAC, guy, you know, that the speech Trump gave at CPAC focuses much ire against folks like Paul Ryan and George W. Bush as it did against Joe Biden. And it was a similar theme over the weekend in Waco. And look, I think there's a civil war really within this Republican Party that Trump seems to be winning right now because he's fighting it. And a lot of the primary opponents or potential primary opponents are laying down their cards. They're laying in not fighting back quite as aggressively. So this is going to be the storyline of 2023. I mean, I think a lot of this stuff sounds totally alien to most people's ears, the notion that you would be running to you know, defend the folks who rioted and were, you know, rioting on the Capitol and are in jail on January for their actions on January 6th. It seems kind of nutty, but that is where a lot of the Republican Party base, the Trump base at least, is these days. And if he has 30% of the party, 35% of the party that is with him on that, that's a powerful faction. So this is, you know, this is going to be a very messy, ugly primary. Ron DeSantis has been taking a lot of that friendly fire in recent months, maybe not so friendly these days. And, you know, look, the Republicans who make up the majority of the party, if they don't fight back, if they don't make the contrast and make the argument, they're not going to win the fight. And Trump certainly has momentum. And even as he's talking in increasingly kind of extreme ways about our democracy.
Well, it seems like a lot of people are wondering, oh, you know, why is Ron DeSantis faltering and crashing and his numbers, like, you know, his campaign is not doing well. There is no campaign yet. He won't announce probably for months. I think this is much less about DeSantis or Trump's attacks on DeSantis. He keeps doing them. As I mentioned, even with the hardcore rabid MAGA crowd, a lot of the DeSantis stuff was falling flat with the crowd. Very stale applause lines, you know, some golf claps, nothing like some of the other responses that were getting people really revved up. I don't think it's about DeSantis or anyone else. I think this is about Alvin Bragg, Trump in the crosshairs, Trump again being targeted by what I think in this case a lot of conservatives rightly see as a witch hunt and a ridiculous effort by the resistance left to weaponize, you know, the justice system against Trump, and Trump being where he loves to be, which is right in the middle of the limelight with all of the oxygen flowing directly into his operation, his campaign, his ability to, you know, pick up small donors and get Republican voters in general to rally to his side. I think that's what we're seeing right now. I don't know if it's sustainable. Maybe it is. I don't know what it'll look like months down the line if some of these people decide to actually start making a contrast. Because, you know, to your point, DeSantis has said a few things here or there, relatively tepid. The other people who are in the race have said basically nothing at all about Donald Trump. Others might get in or might not. We're still waiting on Pence and Pompeo and a couple others as well. Maybe Chris Christie is showing some interest, but it's been a lot of just sort of like standing around and looking around so far. We know how that went last time. And I guess people are like, you know, either scared to do it or not sure how to play it or waiting for their moment. Of course, some of them aren't in yet. I just wonder what you think about some of the timing, because we've had a very, very small field here frozen for a while at this point.
Well, big picture guy, I think a lot of Republicans either thinking about running or folks who are already in the race thought Trump would fade on his own. There was a moment we talked about this. I was probably one of those.
But that's what everyone thought. I mean, Josh, sorry. That was the working theory of a bunch of failed campaigns in 2015 and 2016 exactly. Against Donald Trump. And if people are going to again labor under this crazy delusion that Trump will just magically go away, right. I mean, I can't describe how stupid that is.
You're absolutely right. And look, we remember what happened in November, December, January. Trump does badly in the midterms. His party, the candidates who were tied most closely to him, badly underperformed. You had the Mar-a-Lago dinner with Kanye West and an anti-Semite and white nationalist and Nick Fuentes. You had a very sleepy announcement speech. So there was sense that he may be fading on his own. Maybe that right. You never want to bet on your opponent, like, you know, messing up. You always want to run the best campaign you can. But I think there was almost like a period where the candidates thought they didn't have to do the hard work of beating Trump and going after him and learning the lessons of 2016. And only belatedly, I think people are realizing, oh my goodness, like this is Donald Trump is a lot more formidable. And I think people like Republicans, even if they may not agree with everything he says, they like the fact that he's an alpha macho kind of setting the terms of the debate. That's what owning the libs, owning the establishment. That is what made him so appealing.
And also, right, he's also under attack from a lot of shared enemies, which is why I think this whole Evan Bragg potential indictment thing is manna from heaven for him, because yeah. It kind of freezes everyone else in place. You know, if the indictment were to come down, I think a lot of people would see it correctly and rightly as totally politicized and political. So he would fight it as such. He already has been doing that preemptively. That redounds to his benefit. A lot of the reluctance and flowing away of support from him after the midterms and a lot of his big candidates flopping in that weird rollout that was, as you call it, sleepy and some of the big missteps. I mean, that dynamic could return at some point, but right now he's been very much top of mind in a way where Republicans feel like they have to be on his side. And with no one really coming after him or prosecuting a case against him politically on the right, obviously, this is benefiting him a lot. Now, you have a piece at Axios saying, hold up, though. National polling shows Trump well in the lead, which he is. But some of the early state polling still shows this thing potentially extremely competitive, especially for Ron DeSantis. What are you seeing in Iowa and New Hampshire, Josh?
Yeah, so this is a poll from Public Opinion Strategies. It's a Republican firm that's not affiliated, at least not right now, with any of the campaigns. And it did polling for an outside group in Iowa and New Hampshire for the presidential race. And it found that in Iowa, in a crowded ballot, both Trump and DeSantis were tied. In a head-to-head matchup, DeSantis had a pretty significant edge. In New Hampshire, I believe it was tied in a crowded ballot. Trump still had the lead head-to-head – Trump still had the lead in a full ballot in New Hampshire. But the reality is that if you look at the numbers in Iowa and New Hampshire – they're a lot more favorable for DeSantis than the national numbers. And ultimately, the strategy to winning the Republican nomination is through the early states, Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, and Nevada. So, look, I still don't think it's great news for DeSantis. The trend line, he was up in a lot of polls a month ago, and now he's, you know, in these polls in early states, he is either tied or with a small lead. But, you know, I think the reality is tactics will matter, strategy will matter. Both campaigns need to have their A game, because it's not just going to be who's leading in the national polls. It's how do you play the constituencies in these key early states.
Right, because, I mean, if you build some momentum in the early states, then other people start paying attention. People like getting on bandwagons. People like to get behind a winner. The early states matter a lot. And these are very early polls in early states where you have a field of three people right now. But, you know, there's, I think, in your piece at Axios, some good news there for the DeSantis team, saying, look, this is a very viable thing that we can jump into if and when it happens, let's say, in June. And even by, you know, August, and we're starting to see debates, and then into the fall, this current moment in time would feel like ancient history in our political news cycles. That's all true. But the other side of it is, nationally, Trump has, you know, total 100% name recognition. He is the former president of the United States. He has that extremely loyal base of support that will be with him no matter what. And as you pointed out, in Iowa and New Hampshire, in these polls that you just have been privy to, one-on-one, DeSantis is tied with or ahead of Donald Trump. Not one-on-one, with more people in the field, the advantage shifts more towards Trump because the non-Trump vote gets splintered around. So it's still a long way to go. It's a very small field. I know you had called months ago that the GOP field would be under 12. That's looking smarter and smarter. I had one, I think Karl Rove here guessed the other day that it would be 7 or 8, if that. Does that sound right to you, by the way? 7 or 8, does that sound ballpark to
you?
Yeah,
that's exactly what I would say. I mean, I think Mike Pence very seriously looking at getting in. Chris Christie, you mentioned, he's in New Hampshire this week. Maybe Mike Pompeo. I think he's another candidate to look at. But, you know, they're not much more than that. I think that's – and DeSantis, of course. But it looks like everyone realizes that he is running for president right now.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, he's running. He just hasn't announced it yet, and he hasn't stood up anything, and there's no ads. He's not doing campaign-type events. He's starting to do, you know, book events and then some of these interviews. And that might get really more real, more tangibly real in late May or early June, is at least the reporting. We'll see. Josh Krasauer, so much to get to. We didn't get to everything, but covered a lot of ground. Editor-in-chief, freshly named editor-in-chief at Jewish Insider, and still senior politics reporter at Axios. Josh, always enjoy it. Thank you.
Thanks, Scott.
Let's take a break. We'll come right back. Short segment ahead with some updates and some breaking news that you don't want to miss on The Guy Benson Show.
Energetic, informed, fast-paced. Guy Benson Show.
It's The Guy Benson Show. I'm Guy Benson. Welcome back. I want to bring you up to speed and a Fox News alert on some breaking news earlier today that we mentioned at the top of the show. There was a shooting this morning at the Covenant School, a private Christian school in Nashville, Tennessee, a pre-K to sixth grade institution enrolling about 200 kids, and a 28-year-old woman armed with at least three firearms, according to authorities, showed up today at the school, opened fire, killed three children and three adults before being killed herself by the police who responded. We are told that the entire episode lasted 14 minutes. I'm sure absolutely terrifying for everyone involved. She did not make it to classrooms. This was in like a hallway or a vestibule, like a greeting area in the school. So that's what we know so far. Officials say that they are looking into a possible motive for this woman. Again, 28 years of age, a white woman who is said to possibly have attended this school at some point. Although, as I mentioned, that would have been years ago because she was 28. The school cuts off at grade 6. So there's a lot of open questions about this. The police are expected to give us another update here in the coming minutes. We will monitor and bring you any updates as needed, but it's just an absolutely horrific story. We played sound from President Biden expressing condolences and admiration for first responders. He also called for an assault weapons ban. Immediately he came out and went in that direction. And we still don't know exactly who this was, why she did what she did. The investigation underway in Nashville on a very, very chilling and sad day in that community. It's the Guy Benson Show. We'll be right back. Halfway through the Guy Benson Show on this Monday. Thank you for being here. Glad to have you. GuyBensonShow.com. Podcast is always free every day on demand. With me now, Congresswoman Kat Chemack of Florida, the 3rd Congressional District down in the Sunshine State. And Congresswoman, it is great to have you back on the program.
Hey, Guy. Man, that was a good little bop you guys were playing there.
We have some fantastic bumper music, I have to say. And we don't actually have the rights to play it on the podcast. And I sometimes get notes from listeners saying, you always mention your awesome bumper songs on the air. And because we can't play them on the podcast, our listeners on that format can't hear them, can't hear the songs. I'm like, well, this is why sometimes you got to listen live, live stream on the affiliates. Because if you miss that, we really do curate our bumper songs very closely and carefully here on the show. So I'm glad that you showed it some love. Congresswoman, I want to ask you first and foremost about last week and the TikTok hearing on Thursday. I know it got a lot of attention. I know there was pretty bipartisan agreement that a lot of the answers provided by the CEO of that company were not satisfactory. And you don't see a ton of agreement across the aisle these days in D.C., but TikTok seems to be one of those issues bringing Democrats and Republicans together. What were some of your big upshot takeaways from that hearing?
Where to start? Think about this. TikTok is an extension of the CCP. We know that. Everybody knows that now. And it was pretty evident that they were more concerned with trying to distract and deflect than actually address some of the major concerns that both Republicans and Democrats had, and brought us as the two parties closer together by the end of the hearing by his sheer lack of ability to answer a question clearly. We asked about data and privacy concerns, and he kept pivoting to Project Texas, which is a pilot program that they haven't even launched yet, and refused to talk about its parent company, ByteDance, which we know by Chinese law has to have representatives from the Chinese Communist Party on their board and in their senior level management. We presented internal memos that had been leaked that talked about how TikTok employees were supposed to downplay the ByteDance connection and downplay the Chinese connection. If they have nothing to hide, why would they circulate a memo like that? I think it really clouded the entire discussion when he started talking about Project Texas and what they want to do and what they will do instead of addressing what they have not done, which is protect American users' data.
And it kind of seemed like he was trying to say, look, we're building this firewall and it's an American offshoot of the company and don't really worry about ByteDance and all of that. But that didn't really, like, the ByteDance assurances didn't seem to sit well with you guys, because ultimately, as you mentioned and referenced, Chinese law requires the CCP to have access. If they ask for this data, they'll get it. And he did concede that that data has flowed to sources in China already in the past. I mean, if this was meant to be a reassuring performance under oath, I'm not really sure that was a mission accomplished moment for TikTok.
No. In fact, at one point in time, I forget who mentioned it, but there were members of ByteDance and subsequently the CCP in mainland China who accessed American users' data to pinpoint what journalists were writing stories about TikTok, what their geolocations were, what keystrokes they had made on their phone while using the app, and who they were communicating with.
Yeah, it's creepy.
And that was because they were fearful of negative stories and sources within the company. To me, that's pretty damning stuff. They're targeting journalists who are writing possibly negative stories. It makes you wonder of what they'll be capable of once they have harvested the data and keystrokes and biometrics of 150 million Americans, particularly young Americans who in the future could be members of the military, first responders, those in federal service with, security clearances.
political leaders. Yeah, I mean, the list goes on. And that's part of the thing here, Congresswoman. Like, what is already happening with TikTok, I think, is concerning unto itself now. I think there's also a graver concern about what could happen in the future. I understand that you might not want to jump in and ban an entire app because of hypothetical future worries about something or applications that might come down the pike, because I know a lot of people have pointed out, well, what about the privacy concerns with Facebook and Instagram and Twitter and these other, you know, Google, these other giant companies? I share some of those concerns. I also think that there's a qualitative difference between major tech companies that are based here and are American companies and companies that are directly tied, whether you want to admit it or say it outright or not, to the Chinese Communist Party. That, to me, is a very big, bright line.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the big thing, is we all share major concerns about the Fourth Amendment violations that so many of these companies have engaged in. This warrantless data collection that is then subsequently collected and then sold, and sometimes sold back to government agencies, which we've discovered through the Weaponization Subcommittee here in Congress. That absolutely needs to be addressed. And there certainly are concerns about the suppression of our First Amendment rights through these social media companies who censor, deplatform, et cetera. And we need to address that, yes. But there is a massive difference between a nation like China, the CCP, who is our number one foreign adversary, who seeks to undermine us at every turn in every sector, who is engaging in asymmetric warfare, seeking to corner the information economy, because information is ammunition, and they are loading up on ammunition in order to take us down. This is the same nation that has a citizen scoring based on your biometrics and how good and well-behaved you are. Don't think for one second it's out of the realm of possibility that they will use the biometrics that they collect on Americans, who then subsequently become leaders, military, et cetera, and target them. They have now exposed vulnerabilities in our citizenry that will be used against us.
Congresswoman, when you hear, for example, one of your colleagues like AOC just join TikTok for the purpose of kind of defending TikTok and saying there should not be a ban, there are some of your colleagues, despite a lot of the, I would say, heartening and encouraging bipartisanship, some Democrats saying this is about xenophobia and racism against Chinese people. One of your colleagues from New York, a Democrat, said Republicans want to ban TikTok because they have no swag. I have met you, Congresswoman. I would suggest that you have some swag, in my experience. Just how do you react to those types of arguments? Because I know that is being fed, like, pretty steady dose of that stuff to a lot of young people on this platform who like the platform and enjoy the time that they spend on it.
Yeah, I mean, a couple things here. One, the ridiculousness of someone saying the reason why Republicans want to ban TikTok is because they have no swag. Listen, you and I, Guy, we're both young millennials, and we both know that if you have to talk about having swag, baby, you ain't got no swag. And so that was a hit and a miss by my colleague from New York, for sure. And let us not forget that he has 135,000, 138,000 followers on TikTok. Maybe it has more to do with his own personal concerns over that of national security. I saw bits and pieces of AOC's first and only TikTok video, which I believe she filmed in her office, which was very interesting, potentially a security consideration to have there. But something that I found that was shocking was she said, you know, when there's a national security threat, we get briefed. There are briefings available in the SCIF today from multiple different agencies that at any time she could go get, but she chooses not to because she wants to focus on the lowest educated population when it comes to this issue. If people truly understand the danger of what they're doing, it's not just filters and cute dances and trends. It is quite literally a national security risk. And a lot of people are focused on, you know, the deadly challenges and, you know, some of that craziness. It is designed with a behavioral algorithm different than Meta. And I'm not defending Meta in any way. I have my own, you know, issues with them. But the difference is the behavioral algorithm that they use is designed to keep your eyeballs on the screen so that they have longer times of to go through your phone. That, to me, is what is so crazy, is that she has completely ignored the national security implications that are right there in front of her face.
And you're saying, you want a briefing? Go get one. It's available. So just a few pro tips from Kat Chemek to her colleagues, Jamal Bowman and AOC, Democrats, both from New York. Congressman, I do want to ask you about a vote taken last week. We talked about it yesterday on Fox News Sunday. The parental Bill of Rights legislation that came out of the House, and it was almost exactly party line. Every Democrat voted no. Nearly every Republican voted yes. A handful of the hardcore right-wing folks, for various reasons, voted no. But it passed the Republican House. And the argument that you hear from Republicans is, well, this is about just empowering and informing parents. Nothing more. That is what this bill is about. Democrats say this is about book banning and being cruel to children. What was your thought process in your vote in favor of this legislation?
I just thought it was pretty crazy. You know, there were really five basic tenets of this bill that you would think Republicans, Democrats, independents, liberals, conservatives, no matter where you find yourself on the political spectrum, you could agree on. I mean, things like parents having a right to know what's being taught in their schools and seeing the actual curriculum, the reading material, having a right to go in and talk to the teachers and administrators.
Let me jump in, Congresswoman. Let me read to you very quickly two short paragraphs from The Hill and how they summarize the Republican bill. Quote, the measure would require schools to publish their curricula publicly, mandate parents be allowed to meet with their children's teachers, and make schools give information to parents when violence occurs on school grounds. It would also demand that parents receive a list of books and reading materials accessible at the school library and give parents a say when schools are crafting or updating their policies and procedures for student privacy, among other tenets. I mean, every one of your Democratic colleagues voted no on that.
It's pretty shocking. It is shocking. And if you listen to some of the arguments on the other side, AOC took to the House floor during debate and called it fascism. Fascism. The parents wanted to be able to see these things and have this kind of access, which is, in my opinion, very common sense. I think any American with any sort of common sense would say that.
Well, Hakeem Jeffries, the Democratic leader, came out and said, well, this is, they want to ban educating kids about the Holocaust and they want to ban a bunch of books. Like, what is he talking about?
I think that this is the left playbook. They are making things up. When you talk about what has happened here in the last year, where parents have started seeing what their kids are being taught and seeing what books kids are bringing home from school, they're starting to perk up saying, wait a minute, some of this is graphic, pornographic material, and you're in elementary school? I don't want that in my kid's library. Since when does that equate to the Holocaust? It doesn't. That's ridiculous. I think that they are just reaching at any point that they can because they're losing across the board. Parents are concerned. They have a right to be concerned. And this bill empowers these parents and gives them more of a say in their kids' education.
Yeah, and as I said on Shannon Bream's panel yesterday, Congresswoman, it seems as though the Republicans are arguing that informed and engaged parents is a good thing when it comes to kids' education, and Democrats seem to be saying just the opposite. And if that's the way it'll be framed up heading into future elections, I think that's a pretty clear choice for parents. And it doesn't even necessarily have to be, you know, a matter of politics or partisanship. And on the issue broadly of education as well, big day in your home state of Florida, cut 27. This happened just earlier today.
We will be signing legislation which will represent the largest expansion of education choice, not only in the history of this state, but in the history of these United States. That is a big deal. And I can just tell you the tale of the tape, because I think the results speak for themselves.
And he starts to go through what has been achieved recently in the state of Florida on the education front. This is a sweeping school choice bill. There seems to be a lot of momentum for this issue. And again, it doesn't have to be a partisan one. And there's actually some really great Democrats who are allies on this issue. But boy, the teachers unions, Randy Weingarten and that crowd, they have been going absolutely guns blazing against DeSantis in Florida. Ahead of this, the legislature in Tallahassee passed this measure overwhelmingly. It is now law under the signature of Governor DeSantis. Massive, in my mind, massive civil rights win for families and students in your state, Congresswoman. Just want to get your reaction.
once again, Florida is leading the way. We have an incredible governor and leader in Governor Ron DeSantis. And parents should have the ability to have the money chase their student, right, their child. And they should be able to send their kid to any school that fits what that parent is looking for, not based on their zip code. And I think this is a huge win for all of the students, all the parents, and the families. But think about this more broadly, guys. You see the left coming out against all of the school choice movement that's happening. They came out against the Parental Bill of Rights. This just points back to their agenda. It's nothing more than dependency and control, making Americans dependent on big government programs so that they can maintain control. They see that control slipping away. That's why they're getting desperate, and they're saying ridiculous things like what we saw in the last couple of days.
Representative Kat Kamak, Republican of Florida, our guest here on The Guy Benson Show. Congresswoman, always enjoy it. Talk again soon.
Hey, thanks so much. Have a great week.
We'll be right back after this.
The Guy Benson Show. More next.
As we continue on The Guy Benson Show, we played the sound not long ago of the Biden judicial nominee who was asked by Senator Kennedy, John Kennedy of Louisiana, about various articles of the Constitution and what they dealt with. And she said that Article 5 was not coming to mind. And then he asked an easier one, Article 2. She said that one was also not coming to mind. Then we had a similar pop quiz for another Biden judicial nominee the other day from the same senator. This is Cato Cruz under questioning from Senator Kennedy. Cut 26.
Tell me how you analyze a Brady motion.
How I analyze a Brady motion?
Yes.
Senator, in my 4.5 years on the bench, I don't believe I've had the occasion to address a Brady motion in my career.
Do you know what a Brady motion is?
Senator, in my time on the bench, I've not had occasion to address that, and so it's not coming to mind at the moment what a Brady motion is.
I think he went on to say that it had something to do with guns, which is the Brady campaign, not a Brady motion, which is about divulging evidence to the defense in a case. And again, that might not be common knowledge among lay people, but you would think a judge might know what that is, or someone who was appointed or at least nominated to be a lifetime judge at the federal appellate level would be familiar with that concept. Evidently not. Then we had President Biden's nominee to run the FAA, Federal Aviation Administration, which has had some bumpy times recently, some turbulence, we could even say. Some of these close calls, a really brutal summer in terms of air travel, near misses on runways and in the sky and that sort of thing. So this is someone nominated, tapped by the president, to run the FAA. His name is Philip Washington. And Senator Ted Budd, the new North Carolina senator, had a few questions for him, just like basic stuff, I think, in that realm, stuff that you and I wouldn't know. But someone who's supposed to be the chief of the FAA might need to. Cut 24, just an example.
What airspace requires an ADS-B transponder?
Not sure I can answer that question right now.
So what are the six types of special use airspace that protect this national security that appear on FAA charts?
Sorry, Senator, I cannot answer that question.
Okay, so what are the operational limitations of a pilot flying under basic med?
Senator, I'm not a pilot, so...
Obviously, you'd never see that.
And on and on it went, by the way. We don't have time to play the whole thing. Seven questions. This guy went 0 for 7. And that nomination has now been withdrawn. You might look at some of these hearings and some of these questions. And look, people draw blanks sometimes, brain farts, whatever you want to call it. But the amount of ignorance, like prodigious ignorance on basic stuff, core competencies in these realms, I think is telling. It is revealing. And it suggests that perhaps in the Biden administration, they're not sending their best. Final hour of the Guy Benson Show coming up. General Jack Keane joins us as soon as we come back.
It's 5 o'clock in the most powerful city in the world, Washington, D.C. It's time for the Guy Benson Show Happy Hour, sponsored by the Finnish Long Drink. Finland's most popular alcoholic beverage has come to America. Visit thelongdrink.com. And now, here's your host, Guy Benson.
Our final hour is underway on this Monday on the Guy Benson Show. I'm Guy Benson. Glad to have you all on board. GuyBensonShow.com is our website. The podcast is free on demand every day. Follow us on social media at Guy Benson Show on Twitter and on Instagram. You can follow me as well personally on those two platforms at Guy P. Benson. This hour, sponsored by the Finnish Long Drink. I did, in fact, have one over the weekend. I enjoyed it very much. TheLongDrink.com is their website. You can see where they're sold near you as they expand all over the map. You can order online as well. Always drink responsibly. 21 plus only. TheLongDrink.com. With us now is General Jack Keane, a retired four-star general, chairman of the Institute for the Study of War, and Fox News strategic analyst. General, welcome back to the show.
Oh, delighted to be here with you, Guy, and also with your audience. Thank you.
General, I want to start with this. You and I have been talking about the war in Ukraine now for over a year. I think overall we're on the same page about U.S. interests in the region and in that conflict. I'm very much in favor of the U.S. helping and aiding and arming Ukraine defensively to defend themselves against this Russian aggression. I think it has implications not just there, but around the world, with a lot of bad people looking on to see how this plays out. With that being said, General, there are a number of people at both ends of the spectrum, including a number of people on the right, who say we're spending too much money, Ukraine is not worthy of our assistance, at least to the extent that it's getting it. And one of the questions that is raised by a lot of these people that is most compelling to me is the worry that America now has diminished military readiness because of the amount of material that we are sending over to Ukraine. There's a New York Times story that if a war, God forbid, were to break out and we were suddenly thrust into a major world conflict, there would be a lot of equipment and weaponry that would not be immediately available to the U.S. military in our own self-defense right now because of some of these drawdowns on Ukraine's behalf. What do you make of that? Is that a fair concern? Is that an overblown concern? Because I think no matter what, we should all agree that the priority has to be America's defense first, even if we, like I do, support arming the Ukrainians.
Well, it's just simply misguided. The ammunition that we're providing in Ukraine largely consists of small arms ammunition, artillery ammunition, HIMARS, and some other systems that we're providing. The war, if we're referring to the war against China, that's a completely different type of war. It's a high-end air and maritime war and dealt with offensive and defensive missiles, long-range anti-ship missiles, et cetera. And we are not using those missiles in Ukraine, and we're not providing them to the Ukrainians. They have some of those themselves. So, I think it's just misguided to understand the different natures of what these wars are. And as to the amount of money, the Congress has authorized $113 billion in three pockets, and that's humanitarian, economic, and military. And a little over half of that, I think, has actually been executed. And that represents, frankly, 1.6% of a $6.2 trillion budget. And we are not shedding any blood. The Ukrainians are taking all the risk, and it's their youth that are fighting, and the opportunity we have here to stop Russia cold in Ukraine and not encroach on NATO countries. What interests me is that there are four all Eastern European countries that border on Russia that, as a percentage of GDP, give more of their wealth to the war in Ukraine than the United States does. And that is the Baltic states, Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia, and Poland. They were all under the umbrella of Soviet Union and Russia for over 40 years. Those leaders believe, without a doubt, that Russia will encroach on their freedom if they're not stopped in Ukraine. And that is why they are punching above their weight and giving to Ukraine. It makes compelling sense to stop the Russians now, so they do not take on Ukraine and a much larger war. And those who say we want to focus on China, I agree completely. It is our number one priority. But if Russia wins in Ukraine, Guy, China wins. Yep. And we will have to put more forces into Europe because Russia will rearm, refit, and with the confidence of defeating the United States and NATO in supporting Ukraine, they will move as Putin has said they will move, and certainly incentivizes President Xi. We've got to recognize that certainly after this last visit of Xi to Putin in Moscow, these are two peas in a pod together. They are operating in each other's mutual interests, fundamentally against the United States.
Yep, and that was going to be my next question. Looking back last week on that bilateral meeting and all the grip and grins, the deepening of ties between the Russians and the Chinese, I mean, I agree with the point that you made. If the Russians and their really, I would say, incompetent and unimpressive military somehow are allowed to win this war of aggression, that will, of course, telegraph a dangerous message to Beijing. And it seemed like on a world stage, here you have these two leaders, Xi and Putin, sort of flaunting this relationship and how close those two countries are as sort of the key cogs in an axis against not just the U.S., but the West more broadly. To your eyes, what did you see as you watched at least what was publicly available from that summit?
Well, the length of it, 3 days, 4 or 5 hours a day, not counting the social activity in the evenings, really underscored to me the importance of this relationship. This was the 40th time that these two leaders have met. Admittedly, some of that was before President Xi became the head of state, and Putin, of course, was. Putin was in his 23rd year. President Xi is going into his 11th year. They know each other very well. And you heard the departing remark that Putin said to President Xi when he referred to him as dear friend, and that was picked up, you know, by a camera crew. I'm not sure it was intentional or not. Maybe it was. It doesn't make much difference. The expression was genuine and sincere. They have a relationship, and it's defined by the fact that they want the United States to be replaced in the global order of things. They believe the United States and like-minded democracies have had their way for far too long, 80 years, and they want to replace it. And that's what they're about. And President Xi knows full well that South Korea, Australia, and Japan have been supporting Ukraine. And why are they supporting Ukraine? I mean, there's two oceans away because they know that they're next. And President Xi, if China wins and Russia wins in Ukraine, then these countries clearly are going to be impacted by Xi's aggressiveness and particularly by the display of weakness of the United States and the West. And likely that will adversely impact them as they're starting to deal with a much more confident and aggressive President Xi than he already is.
And a junior partner in that malignant axis is Iran. On the Iran front, General, there was this strike inside Syria last week that I know some people paid a little bit of attention to, and President Biden came out and said, we are not looking to get into hostilities with Iran, but we will defend our people. Can you just describe for us what happened there, what led to that U.S. airstrike, and what do you think of that as a response to what the Iranians had already previously done?
Well, the Iranians have been using their militia in Syria and also in Iraq to attack U.S. troops for some time. The aggressiveness of these attacks actually have picked up during the Biden administration, and there's been not much response. I mean, I was surprised when I read that we are now, prior to the recent attacks that took place after our response, there had been 79 attacks during the Biden administration. That is really quite extraordinary. And now most of them were one or two missiles, but nonetheless, it's their aggression. And why are they doing this? Because they want to break the political will and resolve of the United States to leave the Middle East, much as they left Afghanistan. And they believe with this president, given he foreclosed on his ally, the Afghan government and the Afghan security forces, and was willing to risk turning the country over to our enemy and their enemy, they see huge opportunity here. And that is why they become more aggressive. And I think, frankly, we have not answered with the kind of response we should have to actually hurt them in doing this. So it prevents them and forces them to think twice before doing it. And we're not doing that. It's just not significant enough response.
I'm glad that you raised Afghanistan. It was on my list to get to as well. I saw over the weekend a French media outlet had published a photograph that was released by the Taliban, just sort of, you know, in our face, flaunting this stuff. It was an image of a huge amount of American equipment that we had just abandoned in Afghanistan that is now under control, of course, of the Taliban, a terrorist organization. It was, as far as the eye could see, Humvees and other vehicles. And, you know, I understand some people said, well, do they have the keys to all of those vehicles? Can they really use them effectively? Just the fact that U.S. taxpayers spent all that money and American military personnel spent decades in that country to try to avenge 9/11 and set up some sort of stable government, whether you think it was the right thing or not, there was a huge, huge investment in terms of life and blood and treasure in that country. And to just get out of there in such a chaotic way to the point that billions and billions of dollars worth of equipment was left behind, and to see some of that equipment in this almost like fisheye view camera, it just seemed like so many vehicles in that photograph. I was just reminded of it, and I hadn't thought about it in a while, General, and I just had a viscerally angry reaction. Like, what an absolute disgrace. And it's not just about the dollars and cents. It's about the lessons that it sends, the message that it sends to our allies, that it sends to our adversaries, that it sends to our own veterans who served over there, who were just yanked out basically in the dead of night. And we all know what happened in the aftermath of those decisions. I know that for a lot of people in our age of very quick news cycles and short memories, the Afghanistan withdrawal seems like it was a long time ago. My concern is, especially when little photographs like that crop up, the impact of those decisions and that catastrophic failure will be felt for a long time with reverberations that unfortunately send dangerous signals. The Taliban released that, you know, for a reason. They're looking to humiliate us again, right?
Well, this is also misguided. We had 2,500 troops, maybe a little north of that there, when President Biden made the decision in April to pull all of the rest of those troops out and to shut our bases down. All of the equipment that we had had there before had already been taken out of Afghanistan, destroyed, or given to the Afghan security forces. Most was given to the Afghan security forces because it's usable. Now, when we came to the last 2,500, I know for a fact, because I spoke to the commander, Scotty Miller, the four-star in charge, he had three buckets. One, send home sensitive equipment that were not given to the Afghan security forces. Two, destroy equipment that is so worn out, it's not worth giving to the Afghan security forces, and it's not worth repairing. And three, give some more equipment to the Afghan security forces as opposed to spending the money to ship it home. So the U.S. forces that pulled out left nothing. No airplanes, nothing. What you're seeing is U.S. equipment that is in the control of the Afghan security forces. And that is what defeat looks like, guy. The enemy takes your land. It takes the people, and it takes all the military equipment as well.
Right.
And, yes, it is awful to look at. But there is no way that the United States, from the time they made the decision with the amount of people we had, to go to the Afghans and say to them, look, at just in the event that you guys aren't going to be able to hold on here, we better get rid of some of this equipment. That was not going to be said to them. That would undermine them even further than what they already were undermined when we made the decision not to provide them air support, and we pulled the intelligence, and then obviously we shut down all the bases that were supporting.
Right,
but that's what defeat looks like, guy. It's awful.
Very blunt, very stark final line there, one that's painful to hear, but one that I think we need to hear. And we've got to leave it there for now. General Jack Keane, retired four-star general, chairman of the Institute for the Study of War, and our colleague here, Fox News senior strategic analyst. General, always appreciate your time.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Guy. Enjoyed it. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
You bet. Bye-bye. We'll take a break. We'll come right back on The Guy Benson Show.
Fresh conservative talk. Guy Benson Show.
Happy hour here on The Guy Benson Show. So is the Elite Eight over the weekend in the NCAA tournament. couple really good games. In particular, on Saturday, Kansas State and Florida Atlantic, with the 3-seed Wildcats falling to the Owls by 3 points. And FAU has just really exceeded all expectations. They're a 9-seed, and they have advanced now to their first ever Final Four, beating the favored Kansas State Wildcats, as I mentioned. Then the nightcap of that evening on Saturday, UConn and Gonzaga. Gonzaga looking really good in that wild comeback win against UCLA. They just were not feeling it on Saturday night. They played poorly. They got absolutely blown out by UConn. UConn's a 4-seed, but they're playing like a 1-seed, and they look like a freight train. They're not just winning their games. They are blowing everyone out. They are crushing opponents. So at least according to the eye test, I mean, UConn is looking like a juggernaut at the moment. Then yesterday you had San Diego State edging Creighton by a point. 57-56, low-scoring affair. I know there's been some controversy around the foul call at the very end of the game with time expiring. Should that have been a whistle? I mean, you see the replay as a foul. That's a tough spot for a ref. You don't necessarily want to blow the whistle with everything on the line, the game tied, but that's a foul. That affected the shot. So I think they got it right. One of the two free throws was converted, and San Diego State off to the Final Four, beating Creighton. And then you had Texas and Miami. Texas, it was a weird game in that the Longhorns looked like they were in control. They were cruising for most of that game, most of the first half and much of the second half, and then Miami just turned on the afterburners and went on a hell of a run to end the game. They win by 7 points, and they are off also to the Final Four, which will be this coming Saturday. FAU against San Diego State in the early game, then Miami and UConn, the Canes and the Huskies, in the later evening. And those four teams all hoping to make the finals, the championship game, a week from tonight. So if you look at it now, you start with a field of 68. Not a single team that was seeded 1, 2, or 3 made it to the Final Four. You've got a 4-seed, 2 5-seeds, and a 9-seed. Just like none of us drew it up and predicted, which is part of the beauty of March Madness and the tournament every year. You do not know what's going to happen, who's going to get hot, and who's not. The Guy Benson Show Happy Hour continues after this break. Please stay tuned. We are back on the Happy Hour here on the Guy Benson Show. Earlier on the program today, Josh Krasauer joined us. Politics of the day. A lot to get into looking ahead to 2024 and more. Here's a taste of that interview. Just very quickly, I wanted to get your reaction to some overseas news. There have been weeks of huge protests in Israel over a proposed judicial overhaul by Prime Minister Netanyahu and his government. And there have been a lot of dissenting voices coming out right, left, and center about it, and these big protests in the streets. And it seems like finally it came to a head, Prime Minister Netanyahu announcing today that they're going to just punt the issue into the next session of parliament. So not a complete retreat from some of these reforms that he says are necessary. And I've seen some arguments in favor of them, but also an acknowledgement that it is so divisive and unpopular right now that seems like you could describe this as something of a climb down. What do you make of this?
Yeah, I mean, it's a face-saving measure from Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu, who, with a very right-wing coalition, was trying to push for a very ambitious judicial overhaul that the candidate himself didn't really campaign for, but ended up becoming there's a real divide in Israel, but similar to what we see in the United States between sort of the populists who feel like they've been left out of society, feel that they're underrepresented on the Israeli court and the elites. And you see this divide, Guy. Actually, it's not just Israel. It's in almost every Western democracy in recent years, a polarization between the elites versus the average Joes. And that's essentially what this fight is about, even though, you know, it's really about the role of the courts and how much power they have. But there's a real discontent among religious Israelis and you know, Israelis that haven't been represented in society, that they feel like they're being looked down upon. And that's what this is ultimately about. It's a cultural battle. It's something of a civil war that's taken place, and it's filled into the streets of Tel Aviv and Jerusalem and throughout the state of Israel. And look, I think it was not smart politics for Netanyahu to continue pushing this through when it was clear that it wasn't just liberal parties or left-wing parties that were opposed to it. But, you know, there was a lot of opposition from the center and even some conservatives, center-right folks, in both Israel and even in the American Jewish community in the United States. So, I mean, he backed down for now. I heard the speech. It doesn't sound like this is necessarily a permanent surrender and withdrawal of this controversial legislation. But look, it's a lot of people in Israel I've talked to in the last 24 hours are comparing this to sort of like January 6th, that it's just a war between two different factions in the country that has poured into the streets and has shut down essentially the entire country for the last 24 hours.
Speaking of January 6th, much closer to home, President Trump had a big rally in Waco, Texas over the weekend. Thousands of people attended. The president played this January 6th choir song. That I guess includes inmates who called up and lent their voices to this song. His voice is on the track. It's been sort of topping the charts. A lot of Trump supporters have been out there buying it and downloading it. It was played at the rally. Trump stood there very solemnly with his hand on his heart. Just an interesting choice there, as you know, he's clearly kind of not campaigning on January 6th, but leaning into some of the politics around it. What did you think of the rally in Waco? I know some people were commenting about the selection of the location. We know Waco, Texas, some of the history there. The speech that Trump gave, some of it was very typical, like playing the hits, the stuff that we expect from him. He, of course, went after Ron DeSantis quite a lot to pretty muted response from the crowd, it seemed to me. So a lot of potential observations coming out of that Waco experience, Josh. Were there any big ones for you?
Yeah, look, I mean, it goes back to what we've seen in American politics for the last, you know, 7 years, and that the Trump coalition, the MAGA, the biggest hardcore supporters of the former president, they're not really united by policy, but really by a shared grievance against the elites, against the White House and Biden and the Democrats, and also the Republicans that are, you know, the more establishment and traditional Republicans. I mean, we heard that at CPAC, Guy, you know, that the speech Trump gave at CPAC focused as much ire against folks like Paul Ryan and George W. Bush as it did against Joe Biden. And it was a similar theme over the weekend in Waco. And look, I think there's a civil war really within this Republican Party that Trump seems to be winning right now because he's fighting it. And a lot of the primary opponents or potential primary opponents are laying down their cards. They're laying in not fighting back quite as aggressively. So this is going to be the storyline of 2023. I mean, I think a lot of this stuff sounds totally alien to most people's ears, the notion that you would be running to you know, defend the folks who rioted and were, you know, rioting on the Capitol and are in jail on January for their actions on January 6th. It seems kind of nutty, but that is where a lot of the Republican Party base, the Trump base at least, is these days.
My full discussion with Josh Krasauer of Axios, available at GuyBensonShow.com. Also part of the free podcast, the whole show start to finish on demand for free every single day. GuyBensonShow.com, FoxNewsPodcast.com, or wherever you get your podcasts. When we come back, it's the home stretch. There's a trend that's taking America by storm, sort of. We'll participate in it a bit when we come back.
For the full interview and more, go to GuyBensonShow.com.
Home stretch on this Monday. Thank you for tuning in. GuyBensonShow.com. Podcast is always free. And even on tough news days, we try to lighten things up a little bit in our final hour. Because when stuff's heavy, we cover it. We also try to have a little bit of fun on this show each day. Sometimes that's not possible, but I think a lot of the time it's necessary. And on that front and on that score, Christine, last week we were talking about National Cocktail Day, and you had, to my surprise, suggested that perhaps you might need to move on, graduate from Cosmos. And so you had tweeted, I had retweeted it. You got dozens of comments from people suggesting different drinks that you might want to try out. I know that the vessel for the beverage was a key element for you. You like the martini glass highball type thing. So you got a lot of recommendations, and then you ended up going with something new, and we got a very negative review on the group text on Friday evening, I believe it was. You were not happy.
No, I ordered something. It was like cucumber, and it sounded kind of cool, and I really didn't know what mezcal was. I thought it was type of tequila, so I was like, let me change it up. Mezcal, sorry. And that tasted terrible. Like, if you don't like that, I mean, my husband loves that flavor. If you don't like that smoky flavor, that is not for you. I do have to say,
there's a big difference. There's a big difference between tequila and mezcal. And if you like smokiness, then you like mezcal. I am not. We agree on this. I'm not a fan of mezcal. I don't like that taste profile, especially. It's like overwhelming to me, to the palate. And so that is not typically something that I'll order. If I see mezcal in a mixed drink, and I'm sure there are exceptions where it's used in a limited way and it balances with other things, just in general, if I see mezcal, I'm a no.
And it was in a short glass. It wasn't even in like my type of glass. So
you couldn't feel good about what you were holding in your hand.
No, but I have to say, definitely the one thing on the upside was I only had one drink for the entire night, because that one was very hard to, you know, drink, but I didn't want to waste it because it was $15. So
it was like such a buzzkill that you stopped drinking?
Yep, I was done.
Wow, you didn't even switch to Mama's juice?
Nope. It took me the whole dinner to get through that one drink. And then I said, you know what? I'm done. Don't even want anything more. So I guess there's an upside. A lot of people tweeted at me many, many gin-based cocktails.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I am not a gin person. To me, it tastes like a Christmas tree. So maybe I'm missing out on something.
I think, you like long drink. And that's a gin-based cocktail.
That's citrusy, though.
People were suggesting, even Mary Catherine Hamm texted, because she was listening to Bonus Benson over the weekend. She was recommending a gin gimlet. I think you do need to branch out a little bit here. And you should try that. It's not all Christmas tree tasting.
Yes. And then I had a few people making fun of the way I say vodka. They were like, there's a D in there. And I said, mm-hmm. I am saying it with a D. In my mind, I am.
Yeah, but just not so much in the actual saying of the word. But yes, that is well-trod ground for us here, vodka versus vodka. But I think I'm glad that you tried something new. Obviously, it didn't work out. I could have warned you about mezcal, but report back. You'll have to next weekend, perhaps, try something new again, and maybe you'll discover something that you actually sort of like. Wyatt, meanwhile, spent his weekend reading, of course, the Wall Street Journal and coming across, I guess, in the style section. It's his favorite. He really likes to kick back and relax on the weekends with the style section. And I guess there's this trend where it's hashtag pocket dump, where obsessed hobbyists judge people based on what is in their pockets. So you empty your pockets. You reveal what you have on your person, like what you don't leave home without, and then people enjoy sort of analyzing this. And it's a trend, and people are into it. Okay, I mean, I find that a little bit weird. Christine, you were saying that I guess some interviewers have done this in the past with celebrities in their handbags for women, like what do you carry around with you? I remember during the 2016 campaign, Hillary Clinton, it was a thing where she was like, oh, I carry this hot sauce with me wherever I go.
Yes.
Right? Remember that? So I feel like, I don't know, maybe a pocketbook or a purse, there could be something more interesting to that answer, because those things can contain more objects than just someone's pockets. But I guess for the purposes of this conversation, this trend is about what's in your pockets specifically. So, Christine, do you even have anything in your pockets? Do you keep things in your bag?
Yeah, everything is in my bag. Although women are funny. We love outfits like dresses if they have pockets for some reason. We're always like, look, we have pockets, you know, ready to tell everybody, but we don't put anything in the pockets. It's always in my purse. And I would say...
But you just the fact that the pockets are there, but you don't actually always use them? Mm-hmm.
And I will always, if someone says to me, oh, I like your dress, and I will literally say, look, it has pockets. And,
empty pockets. Nope.
Mm-hmm. Empty, but they have pockets.
Hmm. Okay.
But no, I have a purse, and I would say, you know, like I have normal stuff in the purse. The only thing, I think this is a Jersey, New Jersey specific, is I carry around aerosol hairspray with me. Always in my bag. Like, will not leave home without it.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Hairspray.
Always. Yes.
Okay. So for the most part, I don't want to speak for everyone, but for the most part, dudes don't have handbags or purses. So we actually do keep things in our pockets. And when Wyatt was pitching this topic, I'm like, okay, we can talk about it. But my answer is going to be extremely boring. Are you ready for this, Christine? Are you ready for your mind to be blown by my hashtag pocket dump?
Hit us.
Okay. So I have a wallet. I have a phone. I have keys. And I have, this is the really exciting one, a pen. That's it. What else do people have? What else do you have in your pockets? Cell phone, wallet, keys. You don't leave home without the big triumvirate there. My extra thing is having a pen. That's it. And then it becomes like too overwhelming otherwise. Do people have other stuff? Wyatt, do you have anything more adventurous or exotic than that?
Well, you know, you're supposed to lay it out. I have it laid out in the control room here.
Oh, okay.
You're supposed to take a picture of it.
Okay.
And it's a whole thing. And there's
Ready? It's all laid out now. In the time that you said that, it's all laid out. All exciting items.
So, and the phone doesn't count. So you can't. The phone does not count because everyone has a phone. So, but I have my wallet, which I switched from a folding wallet to just a card wallet because I think it's better in terms of just getting stuff. I hate when my wallet just getting bigger and bigger when you put too many cards and money and
George
stuff.
Costanza style.
Exactly. So I just do a card wallet, and then I have.
By the way, I have a leather bifold, a brown leather bifold. I've had a trifold in the past. I've been a bifold guy for a while. It has my initials embossed on it. Since I'm trying to spice up this segment a little bit. All right, so sorry, you've got your extra thin wallet,
and always loose cash. I always just have a few dollars just in case, you know, I need to pay someone off if I'm getting mugged or something.
Wow.
And then I have my Fox ID.
That has a dark DC joke right there. Your Fox ID.
Fox ID, my ear pods, very important, and sunglasses.
Okay.
I always wear sunglasses now, no matter, even if it's not that light outside, I'll still always wear sunglasses.
They like your shades.
Yes.
So I kind of feel, you strike me as the type of guy who might get those transition lenses.
No, right? Absolutely not.
No, because you could go on your morning constitutional hours before the sun comes up, and then hours into your constitutional, the sun starts to rise and your transition lenses start to darken a little bit. It's just something to think about. I've got a blue pen from Staples right there. Very exciting ASMR here. And I've got the bifold wallet, and I have my keys to my car and a little Northwestern keychain type embroidery thing. That's it. So I guess yours is more exciting. Earbuds. Yeah.
Sunglasses. I used to have keys, too, but then now my new building I live in, it's all with the phone. So you put your phone up next to the reader, and it lets you into your
door.
Even
like your apartment?
Everything,
it's
yes.
It's a phone. What if your phone's died?
It hasn't happened yet, and I hope it doesn't happen, because then you have to remember the code, and there's like a little – it's a lot, and it's annoying, but I prefer the key fob thing, but
– Christine, are you just riveted to this discussion?
Oh, my goodness, you guys. This is really just
– I just hope this isn't TMI.
Radio.
I hope we're not going off the rails here.
None of you have a snack, by the way. I always have a snack in my bag because I get hangry. So, you know, there's always like dried fruit, some nuts or something.
Yeah, but that's a bag. It's not your like I don't keep food in my pockets.
Well, you should think about it. You have pockets. They're there for a reason. Start filling them up a little bit more.
No. It's just like, oh, hang on. I'm getting a little hangry. I've got a little leftover stir fry here in my back left pocket from last night. Anyone have any sour cream? Like, it's just, you have limited options, Christine. As you kind of admit, as someone who has pockets and doesn't use them, your pockets are all empty.
I'm actually surprised. Like, I would be so worried if I had a pen in my pocket. Aren't you afraid, like, the pen is going to, like, explode or something and you're going to have ink on your pants?
It's happened once or twice. It's happened once or twice, but I generally find the convenience of needing and having a pen over time outweighs the occasional little explosion debacle.
What about a little flask?
That's my lived experience. Did you ask about a flask?
Yeah, what if you like a little flask or a little nip of something just in case? You just never know.
I'm at work, Christine. I'm at work.
Okay.
Christine has three cell phones. She's got her personal cell phone, her work cell phone, and then her little quote-unquote cell phone that she holds up to her face like she's talking on it and then just a quick little nip and then back to her fake conversation with no one. And that's just an average Tuesday, which is tomorrow. Back here on The Guy Benson Show for that. Looking forward to it. Thank you very much for tuning in. It is The Guy Benson Show.
This is Jimmy Fallon, inviting you to join me for Fox Across America, where we'll discuss every single one of the Democrats' dumb ideas. Just kidding. It's only a three-hour show. Listen live at noon Eastern or get the podcast at foxacrossamerica.com.
Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.